This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, my friends. Yes, we're going to cover the coming crisis again this week. We'll travel to Brazil to find out about those deadly floods, more signs of climate change. You know, the words former AWARE man Barack Obama was afraid to mention in the State of the Union address. Climate change? Not once. Our interview is with Kiko Brito, Communications Director for Greenpeace Brazil. He grew up in the worst-hit area. You will hear an interview with the man Christopher Hitchin loves to attack, Nafis Mosaddegh Ahmed. Nafis has a new book with an important concept, a model for the interactions of the many crises we face. Sure, we have a climate movement, a peak oil movement, foodies and economic critics, but how do the many forces of decline interact? Find out a little bit in our new interview. Despite all this, I'm starting to develop a weird sense of hope. Noam Chomsky says it's over, we are just, quote, kissing each other goodbye. I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. But first, this. This is Alex Smith, your official nobody. Normally, I try to stay out of American politics, but today, I just can't shut up. Maybe tomorrow, like Keith Olbermann or Julian Assange, I won't be allowed to speak freely anymore. I want to say, all hail to the incoming corporate government. Now it's out in the open. Friendly fascism has arrived in America. It's in the big news, you can read about it, and the public doesn't give a damn. Finally, free enterprise and free government have become one and the same. There is a label for that, though. Before World War II, the inventor of fascism, the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, described it, quote, "Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is a merger of state and corporate power," end quote. He was hung for that. Here are just some of the signs that I can't shut up about. I'll give myself maybe 8 minutes, and that's all. Here we go. Remember the Supreme Court decision that allowed U.S. corporations to spend gazillions on election ads because they're persons, too? Well, tight on the Bush-appointed Supreme Court bench sits one Clarence Thomas. Now the Los Angeles Times reports Clarence's wife received $680,000 from the Heritage Foundation. That's the big business think tank founded by giant corporations, including the Koch brothers. You don't buy Supreme Court justice. Just hire his wife. For years, Clarence Thomas has filled in forms saying his wife had no income worthy of note. He lied. There will be no investigation, no punishment. Big-time judges can just go back and change those forms. Can you believe that? Disgusting corruption at the highest levels as corporations pay off a Supreme Court justice. And what about the bankers getting one of their own into the deepest office of the presidency? William M. Daley was on the executive committee at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, one of the biggies, too big to fail, before being appointed as President Obama's chief of staff. And oh yeah, they got a bunch of that TARP money too. Remember all those fraudulent mortgage securities knowingly sold to the public and institutions overseas? J.P. Morgan was part of that. Now we know for sure there will never be an investigation or charges of the big fish. Even more disgusting corruption as bankers openly take over the weak Obama regime. Daley is from the Chicago political mafia that ruled the city for generations before Rahm Emanuel went back to take over the mayor's chair. He is the child of Chicago boss Richard J. Daley, who ruled the city for decades, brother of Illinois legislator John P. Daley, and brother to Chicago's current mayor, Richard M. Daley. Obama's new man, Daley, has been on the board of directors of defense contractor Boeing and drug maker American Company. Even worse, Obama appointed Jeffrey R. Imhelt, chairman of GE, General Electric, since September 2001, as the new jobs czar. GE, the company that sent thousands of jobs overseas in the last decade, closing plants in America. The conflicts of interest are huge. GE is one of the top biggest American defense contractors, and in the downturn of 2008, GE was rescued by the American taxpayer when the Federal Reserve bought $16 billion worth of shaky commercial paper from GE. According to Jeff Gerth of ProPublica, there were more goodies for GE as it became the largest customer of another corporate support program, this time run by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp, the FDIC. That's another $74 billion worth of debt issued by GE and guaranteed by the federal government. Help yourselves, boys. Don't be shy. Until this month, GE also owned NBC and MSNBC. They got permission from the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, to sell a 51% stake of those media companies to the cable company Comcast. The FTC chairman, John Leibowitz, was appointed by President Obama. Now, Wayne Madsen, in his weekly World Roundup, says Obama and FTC Chair Leibowitz were college roommates in New York in the early 1980s. They were both studying in New York during that period, but it looks to me at different colleges. I haven't been able to find Wayne's sources for that claim, but it wouldn't surprise me. I wouldn't usually recommend the Wayne Madsen report, maybe, but he really called it in his last show, which he calls the final triumph of fascism in the United States. As soon as Comcast acquired MSNBC, its highest-rated star, Keith Olbermann, suddenly announced his program Countdown, and the famous Worst Person in the World routine was over. Just a coincidence, folks. Nothing to see here. Move along. I think Olbermann is just a big chill for the remaining journalist serfs left in the mainstream media. It used to be called putting a head on a pike to warn off the smaller rebels. We can expect an almost spontaneous, undirected wave of rearrangements, contracts not renewed, as the media goes even more on the corporate cheerleading team. In a few years from now, I expect that independent journalists like myself may be found irrelevant and swept away. Or the fee-based access system for the internet will exclude volunteers like myself. Prickly truth tellers could have some child porn secretly injected on their computers before a big bust. I mean, who knew Noam Chomsky was molesting, fill in the blank, all those years? Or maybe rape charges from women who bragged about the sex to their friends and deny it now. You don't even have to lay charges to start an international manhunt with a permanent smear on the name. That's Julian Assange, and that's how fascism works. Okay, here's another sign of the time, this time from the state of Arizona. That grand state of Arizona has a plan to help its people cope with raging budget deficits. The state is moving to cut 280,000 of its poorest citizens off Medicaid. For the sickest, it's an invitation to move to another state. Ah, who needs all those cripples and grandmothers and kids who need special care? We may see migrations of the poor from state to state, as happened to the poorest people of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Then we'll get media success stories about the few who prosper, who benefited from having their generations-long community destroyed. Sign again when you see unions blamed for the poor state of the economy instead of the men who ship production out of the country. That's corporate fascism at work. Union busting has gone one step bigger. Bust the old pensioners collecting that money they paid in over 30 years of work. Strip those old people of their pension money. Yeah! It's happening right now all over America. If you are a municipality, a state, or a big company who spent all the pension money on something else, just declare bankruptcy. The federal government is working on legislation to allow states to go bankrupt. Then all those public workers can be kicked out on the street. Hey, thanks for your years of service. As you heard on Radio EcoShock from our guest Bruce Gagnon, there is a method to this madness. Big corporations and the Pentagon need the last tax money to keep developing their plans for total control of space and from space, the planet. They get rid of entitlements, ooh, how evil, which means taking care of the sick, the disabled, and the elderly, to keep money for corporate big boys like Lockheed Martin. I always thought it was sick that the Vice President Cheney's wife, Lynn, was on the board of directors of Lockheed Martin. She stepped down in 2001, but maybe she remembered a few names and phone numbers. Lockheed Martin gets about one of every $14 spent by the Pentagon, and that's gazillions, people. Read the article by William D. Hartung in Tom's Dispatch, republished in Mother Jones, January 12, 2011. Just listen to what Hartung writes. True, Lockheed Martin doesn't actually run the U.S. government, but sometimes it seems as if it might as well. After all, it received $36 billion in government contracts in 2008 alone, more than any company in history. It now does work for more than two dozen government agencies, from the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to the Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency. It's involved in surveillance and information processing for the CIA, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the National Security Agency, the NSA, the Pentagon, the Census Bureau, and the Postal Service. Naturally, the company produces cluster bombs, designs nuclear weapons, and makes the F-35 Lightning, an overpriced, behind-scheduled, underperforming combat aircraft that is slated to be bought by customers in more than a dozen countries. And when it comes to weaponry, that's just the start of a long list. In recent times, though, it has moved beyond anything usually associated with a weapons corporation and has been virtually running its own foreign policy, doing everything from hiring interrogators for the U.S. overseas prisons, including at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba and Abu Ghraib in Iraq, to managing a private intelligence network in Pakistan and helping write the Afghan constitution, end quote, from William D. Hartung. Read that, folks. Find the links for all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. And it's not just in America. If you want to know what is happening in your community now, check out the undercover cops that were dragged out from under the stones and exposed in the United Kingdom. At least four British longtime environmental activists have been exposed as police moles. The taxpayer created these long-haired, rabble-rousing climate campaigners and animal rights activists, and wouldn't you know it, they are always the ones suggesting violence, entrapment, pure and simple, another fascist tactic. One agent slept with a woman to get information out of her. Is that part of the police code of conduct? Was she raped by a person in authority without her consent? Get all the dirty news at indymedia.org.uk. You can bet that's happening in North America by the underemployed minds at the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and all those nameless things they've set up in our names. Corporations rape the land, the sea, and the atmosphere, and we, the taxpayers, investigate those who object. The people trying to save a livable world. That's fascism, too.
I'll be out with good time by 2009. I hope there'll still be some old professors. And the fellow who looks just like Jim Gray, he sure ain't a sharing myself. He was a spy for the FBI.
An author named Bertram Gross got it all right in his 1980 book, Friendly Fascism. That's still worth a read, published by Southend Press. I've got a link to some online excerpts in the ecoshock.info blog. Here is one sample from Bertram Gross. Quote, "As I survey the entire panorama of contending forces, I can readily detect something more important, the outline of a powerful logic of events. This logic points towards tighter integration of every first world establishment in the United States. It points towards more concentrated, unscrupulous, repressive, and militaristic control by a big business, big government partnership. That to preserve the privileges of the ultra-rich, the corporate overseers, and the brass in the military and civilian orders, they squelch the rights and liberties of other people, both at home and abroad. That is friendly fascism," end quote, from Bertram Gross. By the time David Corton wrote When Corporations Rule the World in 1995, it was already too late. Now they do run America right out in the open, with bankers and CEOs moving into the White House while billionaires buy the elected representatives. I'd like to close with one more quote. "Through clever and constant application of propaganda, people can be made to see paradise as hell, and also the other way around, to consider the most wretched sort of life as paradise." Adolf Hitler said that. I don't know who sang that song for Earth First about he looked like Jesus, but he was the FBI. And our background music, though, was the appropriately named Club to Death by Rob Dugan. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. At the start of 2011, there have been a series of heavy rainfall events in several parts of Brazil. You may have seen the news footage of incredible water and mudslides pouring through towns. Over 800 people lost their lives. To get the inside picture, we now go to Rio de Janeiro to speak with Kiko Brito of Greenpeace Brazil. Kiko, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi. Hello, Alex.
What a tragedy for the country of Brazil. Can you tell us what happened?
Actually, what happened is that on January 12th, it rained on a region about, you know, it's a mountainous region about 100 kilometers from Rio. It rained about 260 millimeters of rain in the span of just 12 hours. Usually, the average rainfall in the month of January in that area of the country is around 300 millimeters. So close to 80% of the water this year came down in just 12 hours. And it hit an area that is heavily populated. with a lot of people living on areas, as we call them here in Brazil, areas of risk, you know, mountain slopes, you know, margin of rivers. Most of these are illegal occupations. And, you know, when the water hit, there were no trees, no massive trees to speak of to hold the terrain in place. So the world came tumbling down, basically. It was slated by the UN last week as being among the 10 worst mudslides in world history.
Were there any natural areas that weren't built up that could be used as a comparison where perhaps damage was less?
Well, actually, I can give you a little bit of history. This is an area that I know quite well. I spent most of my childhood there. You know, it has always rained heavily during the summer in that region. And, you know, mudslides are a fact of life. You know, you didn't have so many people before in the area, and you had much more forest cover, meant that, you know, the trees acted as some sort of natural defense, keeping the mudslides in check. They wouldn't avoid them, but they would preclude them from having such a catastrophic consequence. These heavy rainfalls have been increasing over, you know, a decade or so, and the less big rainfall in that area was last year, and then there was another huge concentrated rainfall in 2007 and 2006. So, you know, now you have sort of these extreme weather events happening in areas that are much more heavily populated, and so the conjunction of all these factors just have made the consequences of these storms catastrophic.
I understand there was also a flood in Maranhão near the mouth of the Amazon in northern Brazil. We've got 190,000 people forced from their homes there and an important iron mine cut off. What do you know about that?
Well, the effect of life in Brazil, you know, like blizzards in Canada. We are in the tropics. We have two big rain seasons in Brazil, both in the summer. But, you know, Brazil being a big country, we have summer in the northern part of the country in June, July, and August, pretty much, you know, it's in the northern hemisphere. And in the southern part of the country, summer comes in December, January, and February. So we have had these torrential rains in the Amazon. And on the other hand, we have also had extreme droughts in the Amazon over the past ever since 2005 being the biggest drought so far recorded in Amazon. And then last year we had another one along the basin. The Negro River is a tributary of the Amazon. These rains are clearly in their strength in Brazil. Right now, south of Brazil, in a state called Santa Catarina, which was ravaged by heavy rains in 2008, is already suffering with floods, and, you know, about 50 people have died already there. So, you know, heavy rainfalls in Brazil are a way of life, but the truth of the matter is that they're becoming stronger, and they're falling over areas which are and with less forest cover, meaning that the mess is all over the country pretty much the same. Right, we had heavy rains in the northeast of Brazil, which is an area, it's a semi-arid area of the country. We had heavy, heavy rainfalls in February of last year, killed, you know, more than 100 people. So I guess that Brazilians will have to get at least used to the fact that, you know, the weather and nature are not going to be kind as they have been with them.
President of Brazil, Da Silva, has said, and I quote, "We need to look more seriously into the climate situation these days. Something is changing, and we still have time to fix it." So does Greenpeace think human-made climate change is also a factor in these so-called natural disasters?
It's a little premature to affirm that. What we believe, based on a number of scientific studies that have been put out over the last decade, is that in as much as you can't attribute these things with 100% certainty to climate change, the pattern does fit the description of what would happen to the climate in Brazil in a warmer world. So there's a good chance that weather patterns are changing, you know, and rains are becoming heavier and more concentrated. Droughts are becoming longer than they used to be. So it's nature sending a sign that we should be more cautious than we have been.
Brazil is part of a group of countries called BASIC, and I understand there's an upcoming meeting of those countries in India. Do you know whether this will change Brazil's position on climate change, or what is Brazil's position on climate change?
Very hard. I don't think so. Based in past history, you know, these floods have been getting worse, or these extreme weather events have been getting worse. We had a hurricane in 2005. That was a first in Brazilian history. We never had hurricanes. But, you know, once the summer is gone, people get back to their normal lives, so do the politicians. And most of to be done in order to avoid the consequences of these extremes are already written down. You know, it's in the planning board of the government. It's just that, you know, during the flood season, governments will say that they're doing a lot of stuff, and then comes the next flood, you realize that they didn't do anything. As far as the BASIC meeting, Brazil and the BASIC have had sort of a contradictory type of behavior. For example, Brazil in Copenhagen in 2009 made a commitment of reducing emissions. It was a voluntary commitment. And in a way, together with the Chinese, the South Africans, and the Indians, you know, it gave a little bit of hope to the rest of the world that, you know, you're forming a diplomatic group that could push the climate agenda to the rest of the world. Well, in Cancun, the BASIC didn't play any significant role. And in been other BASIC meetings since Copenhagen, and nothing concrete out of them. The Brazilian agenda with the other BASIC is still dominated by economic and development issues. I would not expect much, but Greenpeace will continue so that something good comes out of these meetings.
What is your feeling about the way Brazilian people are feeling about this now? I mean, does it feel like a state of emergency, even though you've had floods before? Is this one something like the big one?
The country was taken by a sense of hopelessness once it started to see the images of what was going on in the area that was ravaged by floods in January 12th. And the amount of solidarity that the country displayed so far has been unique in Brazilian history. You know, their donation centers were set up throughout the country. For the first time in many, many years, the Brazilian Blood Bank had to turn people away because it didn't need more blood. That's quite unique for the Brazilian Blood, which is run by the government. So there's a sense of national shock, and there's a sense also that something must be done. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that if these years serve as an indication, one, the rainy season is over, perhaps people will just go back to their lives and they will stop putting pressure for things to change. So, I don't know, let's wait and see. Perhaps this time things will be different. You know, there's a lot of talk in the country, in the media, and even among politicians, that Brazil should pass a law to make governors and presidents and mayors responsible for not protecting their population during the floods, because, you know pretty much what you have to do. You have to remove people who are living in areas of risk. You have to plant more trees. And we have to stop thinking that, you know, we can just pull out reavers inside pipes, that's also a problem that we have here. You know, we keep changing the course of rivers and so forth, and that's not good. At some point, rivers don't like it. They break away from these that human beings have set for them, and they go back to their natural courses. So let's hope, but let's wait and see.
Kiko, is there anything that you would like to add that you would like people here to know about?
Basically, you know, just the last tally is 25,000 people displaced, and the tally of the dead, they're expecting that it will go over 1,000 people once they finish the cleanup, which might happen within 2 months or so. And then, you know, there's the recovery. The estimates right now by officials is that the area will not be back to normal until perhaps 2014-2015.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Kiko Brito from Greenpeace Brazil. For more on the Greenpeace climate campaign around the world, go to greenpeace.org. Thank you so much, Kiko.
You're welcome, Alex.
If we look at what's going on in the world today, we see so many different things happening at the same time, and it can be very confusing trying to make sense of the debates around these things. But when you actually look at these things holistically, it starts to make some sense. Unfortunately, what we have at the moment is a lot of people in different fields looking at everything in isolation. So you've got one lot of people looking at climate change, one lot of people looking at energy, another a bunch of guys looking at food, and some other guys looking at the economy, and then some other guys looking at terrorism and foreign policy. And what I think is really important to do is to look at these things as part of a global system. And when you do that, you actually come away with a different perspective.
Hey, Judy, how about a couple of eggs this morning?
Okay, dear. Oh, but get a move on or you'll be late.
It's a great life, eh, Bob? When you stop to think about it, we take a lot for granted. And why shouldn't we?
My view is, having looked at a lot of these trends, is that some of the most worrying projections are most likely to be true. If you look at these things in their totality, what we're seeing is industrial civilization is now reaching a major tipping point. It's not saying that it's the end of the world, but it's saying that it's the end of a particular form of industrial civilization which is based around unlimited growth and unconstrained interference with the natural environment. And that form of civilization has to change. And if it doesn't change, it will not survive. And either it's going to go down with a bang, or we could see a much more positive and sustainable change. But either way, all of these different crises are really just different manifestations of the fact that this civilization in its current form cannot survive the 21st century.
That's a trailer for a new movie based on the book A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. The author, Nafees Mosaddegh Ahmed, coming up next on Radio EcoShock, after this little tribute to our Wall Street government by Rye Cooter.
Big crap game. Certainly was against my will. I lost every doggone nickel I had, but a greenback dollar bill. $40 bet ain't on the floor. My buddy's point was 9. Well, the police, they're coming now. Caught all of them, but I got mine. Society says I got mine.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock has tracked the climate crisis. We've heard experts on peak oil and energy scarcity. Recently, Lester Brown told us about the looming food shortage. Add in terrorism and war, and yes, this civilization has big problems. Are these threats like separate rivers, each running with their own authors and institutes and their own movements? Or do we really face a single very complex problem with threads that interact with one another? That is the view taken by our next guest, Nafiz Mazadek Ahmed. He is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. He's in London. He's been a teacher of international relations and an author of several books on terrorism. We're going to explore ideas from his new book, A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. Nafiz Ahmed, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Great to be here.
Well, Nafiz, it was only recently that peak oilers and climate change activists came out of their silos to acknowledge these concurrent problems. Why did we become so specialized?
Well, I think it's the nature of our scientific disciplines is really to kind of fine-tune and look into things as much as possible, and it kind of is conducive to specialization and separating things out. So inevitably, just by the nature of our inquiry for knowledge, we tend to try to look at the specific causes of specific phenomena. And this has obviously led to major kind of revolutions in our understanding. It has given us knowledge and in a way almost seeming mastery of the natural world. We seem to know a lot more about physics, about chemistry, about the climate, about geology. We seem to know more about these things, but there is a kind of a downside from this, which is the more we kind of specialize, the more we have these seemingly necessary divisions in our inquiry for more knowledge, we actually start missing the very important interconnections between these different spheres. And obviously, in the real world, things aren't as compartmentalized. Everything is connected. And in fact, each of the disciplines that our scientists are looking at are telling us more and more, actually, that the natural world is highly interconnected rather than disconnected. I mean, especially the insights from quantum physics, for example, are telling us that physical reality is really a single whole and you can't really just break things down. So we need to change our whole framework of orientation. And I think really this inability to connect the dots, to kind of see the connections between the different threads, as you mentioned, is now inhibiting us from really understanding the gravity of what we're facing.
Well, could you please outline the six basic threats that you cover in your book?
Absolutely. I mean, I go through them separately in the book, but in doing so, I try to illustrate their interconnections. First of all, I talk about climate change. I then talk about the energy crisis in terms of resource depletion. I talk about the impact that these will have in terms of food crisis and the way these also will interact with the economy. And finally, I also talk about how all of these things interplay with two kind of types of conflict, terrorism, international kind of non-state terrorism as it's often perceived, as well as state terrorism in a way, or state militarization and the propensity of states to engage in warfare. And pretty much across all of these different crises, I approached all of them with an open mind. You know, I myself, when I started this work, I was doing it during my PhD, which was looking at the causes of mass violence, specifically in terms of imperial systems. But it was in doing that kind of research I realized that there were a lot of ecological dimensions to these things, energy dimensions, resource dimensions to conflict, going back many, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. And this is what made me realize that this kind of stuff has a lot of contemporary significance. And when I started looking at things like climate change, things like peak oil, energy depletion, it became increasingly clear to me that the conventional wisdom, the conventional wisdom that was endorsed by, say, policymakers or governments, was really out of touch with the state of the research, actually, you know, looking at what was being discussed in peer-reviewed journals, looking at what was being discussed by academics, by scholars, who were really at the cutting edge of each of these disciplines. It was really clear that what policymakers were doing and planning on was just seriously out of touch with what was going on. And what made it even worse was that a lot of the experts who are looking at these crises were only looking at it through the lens of their own discipline. And even their perspective of the potential ramifications of what could be around the corner was also to some extent limited by their inability to see the interactions.
Well, in just one example, could we talk about how, well, international terrorism could relate to the climate catastrophe? How do those two play with one another?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think a really interesting example that you could kind of take that's happening at the moment is what's just happened in Tunisia. And a lot of people don't look at it like that. I'm not going to suggest that there's terrorists involved in the toppling of the dictatorship in Tunisia. But it's interesting to see how social movements can become radicalized in the context of pressures which are generated by these overarching crises. And one of the things that I was looking at, and I actually drew on a lot, some of Lester Brown's work over the last few years in terms of the food crisis, was how the food crisis is really a complex result of what's been going on in terms of the impact of global warming in terms of food production, as well as the impact of energy depletion, which is interacting with the kind of limits that we're reaching in terms of industrial agribusiness, the traditional techniques of industrial agriculture, which tend to degrade the soil. They're quite environmentally destructive and exhaustive. They're very intensive in terms of water use. All these kinds of things, they're all kind of converging. And I tracked this stuff in terms of the kind of looking at the food crisis. If you look at the way commentators are looking at what's happening now in terms of inflation, they're looking at it from a very narrow lens. They're kind of thinking that, well, it's something to do with the interest rates. It's something to do with monetary policy. But if you have a deeper understanding and you look at the converging impact of these things like climate, energy, as well as the kind of limits that we're reaching in terms of industrial land use, for example, and how this has interacted with the economic system, we start to see this rise in cost that we're seeing now is simply the cyclical impact of what is most likely to have happened in 2008, where we most probably reached a peak in world oil production, a conventional oil production, and certainly we reached a plateau, and that which has been more or less level but declining gradually over the last few years, and this has contributed to rocketing costs, rocketing energy costs, which has underpinned the rise in inflation, which has also interacted with food prices. Now, what's happening is that this actually impacted in the Middle East and Africa, similarly to what happened in 2008, where we had kind of food riots in, I think it was something like 37 kind of less developed countries. We're going through a similar thing again. And in Tunisia, we had massive inflation. Costs of living have been very, very high. Costs of food very, very high. This has really impacted on the economy, and it's just made people really, really angry. And this has been going on. Actually, for perhaps a year or longer, there's been kind of a lot of grievances in Tunisia. People are very upset. Now, obviously, in this particular case, we saw that they got to a breaking point, where people were just very unhappy. They were unhappy with the dictatorship, and they took to the streets, and we had protests. And in this case, we didn't actually see terrorism. What we saw was state terrorism, in a way. We saw the dictatorship trying to take action against the people. There was conflict on the streets, but in the end, we saw a situation where the regime couldn't survive, and we saw a change. But this can have different effects in different parts of the world. So in the UK, for example, we've had massive student protests, which have resulted in actually attacking government buildings, vandalism, that kind of thing. In the United States, we could see this manifesting also in much more willingness to engage in civil disobedience. And we've also already seen this kind of activity in Europe as well, in Spain, where riots have led police to respond by actually shooting people in the streets. Now, if you look at the volatility of regimes in the Middle East and Central Asia, or say Northwest Africa, where we have interests, for example, in accessing kind of cheap, stable supplies of oil and gas, even kind of uranium and other kind of resources, all of these regimes are quite vulnerable. And in some of these regimes, we know that there are kind of radical Islamist groups operating who may actually be mobilized on the basis of these grievances and may find that there's actually a groundswell of support that they can draw on and use to kind of support themselves. So this is really the danger. If we don't really change systemically and structurally the causes behind these things, instead, we're going to end up looking at the symptoms and responding in a reactionary way, and we can end up having a clash. But what we need is not a clash of different ideologies, but really to look at what has collectively gone wrong with the system underlying all of our different societies.
You know, I wish we had a picture for what we're looking at from your book. Is it a six-legged octopus, some sort of living tangle of forces? Do we even have a name for this complex of problems?
I kind of call it a crisis convergence. And I think Thomas Homer Dixon has another name. He calls it synchronous failure. I drew on Thomas's work in my own book and kind of tried to advance it to some extent. But I think Thomas really hit the nail on the head when he talked about how the danger with our current system, and in a way which is unique to previous civilizations, which may have collapsed for a multiplicity of factors as well. But the uniqueness of our current system is that it's globalized. And the nature of the technologies that we're using, and it's not just about industrialization, it's also about how industrialization has enabled information technologies, which have allowed us to increase the speed and frequency at which we transfer money, for example, across the globe. And this has really made it very difficult for countries to kind of do things in isolation. Everything is interconnected. Everything happens at the speed of the push of a button. And that's the danger. So what's happened now is when we have a shock, for example, in the energy system, it immediately is transmitted and impacts on the economy, on finance, on housing, on the way we drive, on our food. And it's because of the way the system has evolved. The system is a fundamentally interconnected system. Energy, of course, energy consumption is at the heart of it, but it's not just energy, it's also our understanding of the way the world works. It's our assumptions about what is good and what is bad. In this case, there's an overriding, I would argue, perhaps neoliberal assumption that we need to continually grow our economy and that this is good for us. It's good for our well-being as human beings. Everything is basically reduced to kind of material consumption and production. So all of these things interconnect. And so the way I look at it is that we need to start thinking about these things holistically and systemically. We can't deal with these crises simply by looking at, let's look at energy in isolation or let's look at the environment in isolation. And if we do that, we'll find that our kind of policy measures or our remedies will be very limited. They won't really deal with the wider systemic issues. And in the end, they'll be futile. We need to start looking at how we can think about what is fundamentally wrong with the nature, the structure of our civilization and what we can do to change it.
Yeah, we have climate change models, big computers trying to predict very complex interactions. And I'm sure, as you say, it's time now for computer models and civilization studies and social movements to try and get these things to interact. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and analyst Nafiz Mosaddeq Ahmed. His new book is A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It. You can find out more about that at iprd.org.uk. That's iprd.org.uk. Well, Nafiz, I want to quickly just touch on one other subject here. You have written books about 9/11 and about the war on terror. Maybe you could explain to me why so many from the 9/11 truth movement switched over to become global warming deniers. You have not, but others from Paul Watson, Alex Jones, James Corbett, even a group from Truth Out showed up to protest the climate conspiracy in Al Gore, so they say. Why this anti-science stance?
Yeah, it's a very worrying trend. I'm not sure how to explain it completely, but I think if you look at some of the characters who are leading this kind of anti-science drive, ironically, in the name of good science, these guys often champion selected scientists whose credentials actually are rather questionable and often have vested interests and connections to the oil and gas industries. But a lot of the people like Alex Jones and others who are leading this anti-science drive, leading this drive to say climate change is a myth. A lot of these guys have a background in extreme skepticism of anything to do with authority. And while I think that any skepticism of authority is justified, it's a skepticism that actually it's not rooted in scholarship. It's not rooted in rigorous research. It's rooted in forming very, very quick, generalized kind of narratives based on perhaps what you might say is a not entirely rigorous analysis of the evidence. And certainly, I think the way that these people have approached issues like climate change come from the perspective of which is already a preconceived perspective, which in a way preceded the time when global warming and climate change became a real issue for policymakers. I think about maybe 20 years ago, we started to see more talk about global warming, but really only in the last 10 years we've seen a real major shift where governments have actually openly kind of said, look, global warming is actually something we need to be talking about and doing something about. And we saw that with the Kyoto Protocol, and there were lots of limitations. The fact that the protocol went through kind of illustrated that we'd reached a sea change. And I think this is the issue. The United Nations at that time was, you know, loudly seen to be backing the legitimacy of climate science and the urgency of the issue. For a lot of the people involved in questioning 9/11, a lot of those people having a background in kind of conspiracy theory and kind of analyzing things from a conspiratorial perspective, a lot of these guys had this view of the New World Order and the idea that the UN was a vehicle of global government. And while I agree that there's a lot of grounds to be skeptical of the structure of the United Nations, it's not a democratic institution. It has, in many ways, rubber-stamped and kind of imperial adventures on behalf of the United States, Britain, and Western Europe. On the other hand, the United Nations is also a forum where its member states have engaged in certainly very, very interesting and progressive ideals to do with women's rights, to do with environmental rights, to do with development issues. Fortunately, I think the guys who are driving this, they just don't understand these complexities in the way the world works. It's very easy to kind of project out there that there is this kind of tiny little cabal who we don't see, who are controlling everything. And absolutely, there is a transnational elite made out of banking conglomerates, elements of governments, you know, defense and arms industries and energy lobbies and all the rest of it and kind of the media. But it doesn't work in this very simplistic way. Even these guys have disagreements. They fight with each other. They don't have the same interests. Their interests conflict. They're competing with each other between different nation states, across different borders, between different companies. And that kind of complexity, these guys just don't get that. They miss that completely. So I think that's really what's contributed to them kind of seeing climate change as a vehicle of authority rather than realizing that it's actually something real. But the other thing, of course, is the way governments have responded to the issue of climate change in terms of real policy. While they have maybe trumpeted that climate change is a problem, I think if we really look and dig deep into the policy prescriptions that have come out of that, look at what's happening in terms of carbon markets, look at what Al Gore, for example, is actually prescribing, look at what governments are actually doing in terms of dealing with climate change, and we find that rather than actually implementing the massive structural reforms and investing, for example, in further research in alternative energies and other kind of things, or looking at alternative political economic structures, we don't see any of that happening. Instead, we see governments holding on fast to power while exploiting the specter of climate change to impose kind of new regimes which will only actually empower and give more profits to very often the same companies, the same banks, the same industries that are driving this process forward. I think that's the big issue that is really kind of making a lot of general people who are just reasonable people but who maybe don't know very much about these particular scientific complexities. And it's and this kind of stuff, they're looking at that. And when a climate skeptic, such as Alex Jones, who has prominence, who maybe gets certain things right, when he comes out and he says, oh, look, you know, these guys are actually just a part of an agenda to control you, it seems plausible. Because in a way, governments are just trying to control us through these measures rather than deal with the problems at hand.
Right, we don't need carbon markets and derivatives and trading and big billions to be made from this problem. We need some clear action. So I'm with you on that. Now look, you spent 2 years as a senior researcher at the Islamic Human Rights Commission and you've written about the Middle East. I'm wondering what you think that Muslim scholarship or academics have to offer us in a new look at some of the problems that threaten our civilization.
And I think the Muslim world is very much behind, you know, on this kind of stuff. I mean, there are certainly, there's one issue, which is the regimes in the Middle East, which are clearly anti-democratic, corrupt. They're a real problem. And a lot of them are clients, they're our clients. So that's the fundamental problem. And these guys, in a way, are actually the same guys who are, a lot of these guys are oil producers. They have vested interests in keeping the machine going. So that's one issue. The other issue, of course, is, as you mentioned, really the scholarly. Are there kind of intellectuals? Is there scholarship? Or what's the ideas that are coming out of the, maybe the more progressive elements of the Muslim world? who are looking at this. And I don't think many people have really looked specifically at these issues in a big way, but there is an emerging movement. There are a number of scholars, certainly based in the West, who are Muslim scholars. They're traditionally trained, but they're versed in Western sciences, and they're calling for a greater environmental consciousness. And interestingly, they're drawing on religious ideas, religious teachings, which teach us to respect nature, to not waste things like waste water, to not overexploit the environment, to be kind to animals. Really basic principles, which I think are common across a lot of religious faiths. I think a common to all religious faiths, there are these common progressive universal ideals, which I think are very interesting and could certainly plant the seeds for dialogue across different cultures to say, well, look, as a species, let's draw on our collective heritage to explore what an alternative paradigm which is much more in tune with nature.
I'd like to get, as we head towards the wrap-up here, you do have that part of your title, And How to Save It. I'm just going to read a quick quote from your book. You say, "The danger of collapse also heralds the hope for catagenesis, renewal through reversion to a simpler state, followed by the emergence of a novel form of society. Global crises are not simply symptoms of a global system's failure. They are simultaneously symptoms of civilizational transition." So, to start with, can you explain catagenesis?
Catagenesis is another term which was used by Thomas Homer Dixon, which I think he drew this from the work of another ecologist. And basically what the argument was, and I tried to extend this in the book to look at these specific crises and how they're interacting, is that when you have a collapse of civilization, if you look at natural systems, you find that actually there's a natural propensity for many ecosystems to renew themselves. And Thomas Homer Dixon gave a number of examples of this, looking at the life cycle of certain animal communities. It was very, very interesting to look at the natural basis, the scientific basis, for this kind of optimism. And so what he tried to do was not to say that some kind of renewal is inevitable. Certainly for human beings, it's absolutely a choice. What I tried to get across in the book is that when you look at the convergence of these trends over the next 50-odd years, and certainly I would say that's stretching it out for some time, we're looking at within the next 10 to 20 years, we will see a lot of these things converging. But as you look at the convergence of these crises, they pretty much make clear that industrial civilization as current form cannot survive the 21st century. It will not survive. Now, the question is really, what is going to come after? Will it be something like a totalitarian, dystopian minefield, or will it be something more progressive, something more in tune with what communities aspire to? And I think that's a choice. I don't think history is written in stone. I don't think there are any deep-rooted teleological forces that are just unfolding and we can't do anything about it. We're just pawns. I think human beings have a choice collectively. And what's kept us in the rut, really, of course, is the fact that the majority of people don't quite understand what's going on. The process of catagenesis is one where human beings actually recognize that these are symptoms of a civilizational change, and that if we grasp the reins of history, we can actually move towards something different, something completely new. And in a way, I see this as an unprecedented opportunity. I don't want to lessen the gravity of what we're facing, because when you look at the warning signs on dangerous global warming, you look at, for example, the rate at which methane is coming out of the permafrost in the Arctic, just as one example of the positive feedback, and the amount of emissions we're already putting into the atmosphere, we are looking at the danger of runaway global warming. And certainly, I would say, issues such as energy depletion and combined with that, and how those interact with the food and the economy, just to name those things. We can't basically underestimate the scale of what's going to happen. But there's no point being absolute pessimist, because if you are a pessimist, you guarantee the worst. So I think we should start thinking seriously about the inevitability of what comes after and see that as an opportunity and work collectively and cooperatively with others to start building those alternative structures from the ground up, because there will come a point where as people become more and more upset about the kind of things that are going on, and people are really angry about the banks, they're angry with their politicians, they're upset about what's going on, they recognize that when we went to Iraq, it probably wasn't the best thing to do. So a lot of people on a whole range of things are skeptical, but it hasn't really been brought together. So what I try to do is really bring these things together into a coherent alternative. And I think when people start to recognize that this is a single systemic problem, and that there is a possibility of an alternative, and we need to start working towards that dialogue to make that alternative more coherent. I think that's when you have that catalyst for a real social movement. Now, we might not be there yet, but I think give it another 5 years, and I think issues like climate change, issues like energy depletion won't just be issues of debate. They will be much more clear, and people won't be able to argue about them. And I think at that point, our movements will actually be a lot stronger. So I'm kind of a long-term optimist in a way.
Okay. Well, A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization, I've just heard that you're also going to make a film about that. Can you tell us about that?
Yep, that's right. I'm working with a young British filmmaker. His name is Dean Puckett. The film is called The Crisis of Civilization. We've been working on it kind of furiously on a zero budget for the last couple of months, and we're hoping to have it out soon. It's going to be, it's an interesting film. We've already shown it to a couple of interesting people in the media who work in mainstream distribution, and they're actually really delighted by it. They found it really exciting. So we're excited that we've managed to put together possibly a film that is going to wake a lot of people up. So that's the hope. If people are interested, they can check out the website for the film, which is www.crisisofcivilization.com.
Crisisofcivilization.com. Nafees, I've enjoyed this talk. Our guest is Nafees Mazadek Ahmed. He is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in London. His new book finally takes the big picture of a half dozen crises, from climate to militarism, that threaten our Western way of life, if not all life on the planet. And maybe he's pushing us towards the next new and sustainable civilization. You can check out Ahmed's blog. It's called The Cutting Edge at nafees.blogspot.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
The latest election a couple of days ago is you could almost interpret it as a kind of a death knell for the species. There was an article in Bloomberg Business Week, you know, not a radical rag exactly, running through the new Republicans coming to Congress, and they're worried about them. One of the reasons is because they are global warming deniers, almost all. That means the powerful House committees, are like science and technology and so on, are going to be in the hands of people who think there's nothing to it, or at least claim that they think that. What they actually think is another story. In fact, one of them was quoted as saying, can't be a problem because God will take care of it. Now, you know, if this was happening in some small country, and, you know, maybe, I don't know what, Monaco or something, it wouldn't matter much. But when it's happening in the richest, most powerful country in the world, it's a danger to the survival of the species. Nobody else is going to do very much if the United States doesn't do a lot. Not just some, but take the lead. So we're essentially saying, let's kiss each other goodbye.
That is Noam Chomsky in a great video available from The Nation magazine. Find that link in my blog at ecoshock.info. But Noam, I think you were wrong. This is not the death knell, but the warning bell. The bell that calls us together in new, sustainable ways. A couple of nights ago, I went to a meeting of a project called Village Vancouver. It's part of the Transition Town movement, which is spreading all over the world. Regular people, seeing the dangers we all see, are meeting to organize food growing skills, exchanges, toy banks, tool banks, ways to work and network and live together in the real world, not the computer world. These people, young and old, are already doing it. There are two-block diets, a tiny exchange. Local currencies are springing up, accepted by some local area businesses. I'm going to be covering that in the future. These building blocks may survive the food crisis, the energy crisis, as Havana did when the Soviet oil ran out. Put it down if you want. I picked up hope. I'm working on a Radio EcoShock show on transition cities. Contribute by writing to me at this address, radio@ecoshock.org. I'm also looking for more women's voices. Send me your guest ideas, please. Thanks for all the supportive emails. You keep me going when nothing else can. This is our media. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening. And tell others about Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.